Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, February 13th. A defense conference is getting underway in Waikiki today. The U.S. military and our allies are in attendance, along with major defense contractors. They are aimed at the greatest threat by what's being called a triad of troublemakers. The clock is ticking on licensing rules to allow midwives to continue practicing. We also hear from a sci-fi writer that imagines an intergalactic Hawaiian heist. Think local kind Ocean's 8. Young readers can learn about Mary Kavena Pukui, the collector of Hawaiian proverbs, Olelo No'iau. A children's picture book brings her story to life. And we meet one of the featured groups in HPR's Mele Hawaii Atherton performance series. An all-male band takes the stage next weekend. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A gathering of top brass is happening now in Waikiki. Admiral Sam Paparo, head of Indo-Pacific, addressed hundreds of military leaders and defense contractors at a Pacific Forum conference this morning. Paparo painted a sobering picture of our aging infrastructure and military readiness. He called on U.S. allies and friends to focus on the threat at hand. China, North Korea, and Russia are becoming more aggressive, and it puts everyone in the region at risk. Paparo pointed to their recent drills for a forced unification of Taiwan. He underscored the urgency for innovation in space to the bottom of the ocean.
The stakes are vital national interests of every state. We sometimes let that get lost in the sauce as we're making these discussions. Also, in the South China Sea, Beijing claims sovereign rights over international water with breathtaking audacity and blatant disregard for international law. They've militarized artificial islands, they've harassed commercial vessels, and intimidated regional nations, including treaty allies, attempting to exercise their legitimate rights, including poor fisher folks. These actions also threaten the free flow of commerce through vital sea lanes that carry over one-third of global maritime trade. More troubling still, we witness an emerging axis of autocracy. The People's Republic of China, Russia, North Korea have formed a triangle of troublemakers. Their joint naval exercises grow more sophisticated in the northeastern Pacific. Their technology transfers increase in scope and in scale, and their diplomatic cooperation threatens to transform the Pacific from free and open to contested and controlled. And we see their coordination in everything from joint bomber patrols that penetrate American ATIS to shared anti-satellite capabilities and advanced submarine technologies, from the seabed to the heavens. So to be direct, our current posture faces serious challenges that directly threaten the security, the freedom, the well-being of the United States and of our allies and partners. And if you are in this room and within earshot of my voice, you, your family are directly threatened. Our magazines run low. Our maintenance backlogs grow longer each month for every critical joint force element: Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Space Force, Coast Guard. Critical air, missile, maritime, space platforms age faster than we can replace them currently, and we operate on increasingly thin margins for error. Our opponents see these gaps, and they're moving aggressively to exploit them. Their readiness numbers tell a stark story. Maintenance delays impact operational availability across all domains, and our precision-guided munition stockpiles sit well below our required levels. Key platforms operate beyond their planned service lives, and the strain shows in both equipment and in personnel. But identifying the threat is only the first step, as they say, in our 12-step programs. We now have to execute our correction. I see certainly unmanned systems as our first, as our force multiplier. You'll be aware of the term hellscape and its association with my name. We have to build these capabilities at scale, network through resilient, multi-spectral communications that can operate in contested environments. And it's not about replacing warriors, it's about giving warriors the advantage they deserve and giving our nations the defense they deserve. Autonomous systems will provide persistent coverage, accept the levels of risk, and multiply the combat power without multiplying our manning requirements. The technology exists, the concepts are proven, but what we lack is sufficient scale and integration, and we've got to move beyond boutique programs and limited deployments to full-scale implementation across all domains. And this is a hard truth. Technology alone is not going to win this fight. We've also got to reform defense bureaucracy with unprecedented urgency. And essentially four lines of effort, among others, is going to help solve. We've been talking about this for years and years. We've got to streamline our acquisition system. And when we talk about innovation, we're always adding some accessory on our program. We're building some little bypass that's going to bypass a sclerotic organ. We've got to do some innovation by subtraction, removing bureaucratic obstacles within our system that impede progress. Every unnecessary review, every duplicative process that damage our readiness. Procurement at the speed of combat, not at the speed of committees. We must push authority down, accept prudent risk, and trust people to deliver. The current system treats a software update with the same bureaucratic rigor as an aircraft carrier. This makes absolutely no sense. We need multiple acquisition paths or optimized for different types of capability. Fast tracks for software and for unmanned systems, streamlined processes for proven commercial technologies, traditional paths for major platforms, but they go fast, and one size doesn't fit all. We've got to have vertically integrated supply chains through AI-aided additive manufacturing, and we're doing a bit of this with the most advanced system in the world, right here in Hawaii. We need the capability to produce parts from propellers to circuit boards on demand. This isn't future tech, it's current capability, and we have to scale it now.
That was Indo-PACOM's Admiral Sampaparo, who spoke at a defense conference in Waikiki this morning. The gathering marks the largest presence of European countries ever, and key sessions will focus on strategies to strengthen ties across the Pacific. A third of all trade happens in this region. Call the midwife. In this case, though, it's the midwives that have been calling on lawmakers as the women try to ensure they can keep practicing legally. HPR's government reporter Ashley Mizuo joins us now to talk about a bill to extend licensing rules that's supposed to sunset this summer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so I know that this issue came up last session. It was pretty prickly. But yeah, it's come up again because there's a sense of urgency now.
Right. Yeah. So in the past, the legislature, like last year, was unwilling to take this measure up or take this issue up, really. Basically, the 2019 law set standards for certification for midwives so that they could regulate that industry. But also it barred traditional Native Hawaiian midwives from performing, you know, their practices. But that law is going to sunset in June. And so lawmakers are working on a measure to replace that. If they don't replace it, then basically all of those licensing mechanisms would no longer exist. Before 2019, Leah Minton, midwives from the Midwives Alliance of Hawaii, says, you know, there was no legal way to distinguish between a midwife who had training and who did not.
It is vitally important that the person who is hiring that service knows what they're getting. And the vast majority of people that we talked to did not understand that they weren't, in fact, getting midwifery services because they had not, in fact, hired a midwife. And when things, unfortunately and tragically, went very wrong, people that debriefed with us of wanting to talk about what happened, it's really devastating to hear how, if that was a midwife, we would consider it exceptionally negligent. But in reality, all I could say was, I don't know, you know, what type of care you received. I don't know what that's called, but it's not midwifery, because in midwifery, we would have, you know, we're trained to do X, Y, and Z. And all of these things that occurred along the way are things that should have been managed differently, that if you had somebody that was trained, would know what to do.
And she says, you know, there was no way for people who received bad care to report it because it was unregulated. So when the 2019 law went into effect, it was a way to protect consumers by, you know, creating these strict definitions of what an official service of midwifery is and how someone can be certified to do those services, and that it would be a criminal offense to offer these midwifery services but not actually be certified. While that did what was intended, it also, you know, barred traditional Native Hawaiian midwives who have had, some of them, years on hands-on training but no formal schooling from practicing. So until 2023, there was an exemption for what's called a birth attendant that allowed them to continue practicing while the legislature was supposed to figure out how to incorporate them in the law, but that actually never happened. And so when that exemption sunsetted in 2023, they were unable to practice and could face fines as high as $2,000 and end up to a year in prison. Ki'i Kaho'ohanohano is one of the Native Hawaiian traditional midwives who sued the state, saying the law threatens reproductive rights, and the case that was brought by the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation and the Center for Reproductive Rights actually secured a temporary injunction from the court in the summer that has allowed some Native Hawaiian cultural practitioners to again begin offering services.
You can't receive any of the care that you get from us at a hospital. And I'm not going to say that we can't bring certain elements in, because if we see during the pregnancy that someone, you know, is not low risk, we don't stay home. We bring whatever we can into those spaces to create that space for ourselves. But we see birth as ceremony. And so when people come to us, we're looking at source of their ailments, of wherever their misalignments, not just physically, but spiritually or emotionally might be. We're addressing what needs to be healed instead of, you know, just shoving it under the rug or giving you a medication to cope or cover it up. Like, we really try to dig deep and go to source so that these things don't come up in birth or in postpartum, for that matter. We teach families how to be whole again.
So that's why this year, you know, they're considering, there were several measures that were introduced in this legislative session to correct some of this, but only one was selected by the House Health and Consumer Protection Committees to advance. You know, President of Hawaii Home Birth Collective, Christy Duarte, said that there needs to be clear protections in that measure for Native Hawaiian healers. And one of the ways that the measure could do that is explicitly saying that Native Hawaiian healing practices are not part of the definition of midwifery services that you need licensing for. And she says that, you know, only from the 41 licensed midwives in Hawaii, only one person was born and raised in Hawaii, and none are Native Hawaiian. The amended version of this bill will likely have that protection in it, but it hasn't been posted yet, so we can't really see what is exactly in this bill. So that's kind of where they're at. And basically, they're trying to balance several different things, you know, Native Hawaiian cultural practices, as well as consumer protection for mothers who are going to be receiving these services and having these births at home. And yeah.
I can imagine you do want standards in this area.
Exactly. And I think they're looking for a way to regulate, but also be fair to people who are practicing in that space and providing those services to make it equitable as well.
Okay. But this is still advancing.
Yeah. So it just came out of the its committees in the House, and it's going to have to be heard on the floor by the full House. And then it'll go on to Finance Committee, and then it'll have to transfer over to the Senate, where they'll do more of the substantive changes, I believe, to the bill as it goes along the legislative process.
Okay. Well, hopefully they can work something out. Yeah, because the deadline is June. That's coming up quick. All right. Well, thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HPR's government reporter, Ashley Mizuo, about a bill to allow midwives to continue practicing in the state. Look for her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. This is a conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. You know, later in the hour, we'll be featuring a conversation with David Del Rocco, the author of the Wayfinder series for young readers. His latest release features Mary Kamenapakui, but he's also written a keiki book about Patsy Mink, and there's a future release that will focus on Edith Kanaka'ole. All three of these women have been featured on coins from the U.S. Mint. Senator Patsy Mink came up with the idea to honor these Hawaiian women in 2021. She sent a letter to the U.S. Mint urging them to feature Pakui, Mink, and Kanaka'ole as part of the American Women's Quarters Program. This year, Mary Kamenapakui is front and center on the 2025 Native American coin, and so is a famous Olelo Noeau. For today's backyard quiz, we want to know, what is the Hawaiian saying featured on the new $1 coin? Bonus points if you can give us the answer in Hawaiian. Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. Pick up a reusable HBR tote bag if you're the first one to get it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for young farmers seeking a future in agriculture, such as the Waianae Community Redevelopment Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
Live from the Atherton, this weekend, HPR presents the Malie Laiman Quartet. This concert is a part of HPR's Mele Hawaii performance series. The Malie Laiman Quartet is performing this Saturday at 6 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m. For tickets and more information, visit hprtickets.org. Live from the Atherton, sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering master programs in finance, information systems, marketing, and travel industry management. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
A young author's debut novel tackles the Hawaiian diaspora, but takes it into the cosmos. Makana Yamamoto is Hawaiian and identifies as Mahu. Yamamoto grew up in Hawaii, but has lived on the continent since graduating from high school. Yamamoto's new novel, titled Hamajang Luck, depicts a high-stakes space heist and has been described as a swashbuckling love letter to Hawaii. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Yamamoto about how the book pays homage to the islands and the importance of writing about trans characters.
I've really been a writer since I was a little kid. My mom and dad like to talk about me writing picture books as soon as I learned how to hold a pencil. They still have this. It's a book that I wrote in like the third grade about my cats going on in an intercontinental adventure, and they still have it. I really started writing more in the fan fiction scene, actually, and that kind of jump-started my creativity back into writing original fiction. I also have done a lot of like tabletop RPGs, a lot of academic writing. So I've been writing in a variety of different formats for a long time.
I want to give readers and listeners maybe a more concrete idea of what they're getting in this book. So what's your elevator pitch for what this book's about?
I think the joke answer I give is that it is Ocean's 8, but it's all lesbians and they're in space. That's kind of my joke answer. I think a more serious answer would be it is a queer cyberpunk space heist.
It's billed as a sci-fi heist, but it also incorporates a ton of Hawaiian language and culture. And is that what you intended to do from the outset? And what did you think, I mean, playing with this form?
It's really funny. The first time I really incorporated Hawaiian culture and Hawaiian language, and particularly Pidgin, as well as Ōlelo Hawaii, I was writing a scene between the main character Edie and their longtime best friend Sai, and they were having this conversation and they were reuniting after, you know, Edie has been in prison for 8 years, they're reuniting, and Sai said his first line of dialogue and it came out in Pidgin. And it completely surprised me. I was like, oh, that's so interesting. And then I was going back and forth about it. I decided to try and rewrite it in standard English, and it just sounded wrong. It didn't make sense. And so I flipped it back, and I was like, okay, this is what I want to do. And from there, I really leaned into the Hawaiian influences. A lot of the book is written in Pidgin. A lot of the dialogue is written in Pidgin. And it just sort of blossomed from there of something that is not just, I glibly call it a sci-fi space heist, but it's also a Hawaiian sci-fi space heist.
And it's also been, I think, it's billed on the jacket as a swashbuckling love letter to Hawaii. Can you unpack what that means?
Yeah, I think swashbuckling in the sense of kind of like, you know, you think about pirates or bandits or outlaws, and it's this scrappy team of thieves who are trying to take down this trillionaire tech mogul who kind of exists in like a Robin Hood, you know, steal from the rich, give to the poor kind of thing. So that's the swashbuckling part. And definitely a love letter to Hawaii in the sense that I wrote about Hawaii with such affection. I love Hawaii so much. I miss Hawaii every day. It was definitely something that I wanted to embody as soon as it came out. It was like, I really want to do right by Hawaii. I really want to do right by my Lahui. I want to really make this a book about Hawaii and how much I love this place. So it's set on the space station, Kepler. And the way I conceived of it is Kepler is a place where the Hawaiian diaspora kind of spread into the stars. This is a little bleak, but it's the idea of a climate catastrophe and displacement and Native Hawaiians and Kama'aina having to leave the islands and kind of go into the stars. So the idea is that the Hawaiian diaspora has settled on this space station, Kepler, and kind of building from there of like, what does this look like? What does the Hawaiian diaspora look like in the year 2170? How has Hawaiian culture changed? How has it stayed the same? So it was definitely an exercise in like, what would this world look like in the future in the stars?
And what do you think motivated you to write about kind of the Hawaiian diaspora in this way? Do you think it was related at all to your own identity as diasporic?
Yeah, absolutely. I was born on Maui and then moved to the mainland for college, and I've kind of been here since then. And so I think a lot of it was missing home. A lot of it was affection for home. I base a lot of my characters and my neighborhoods and the kind of turns of phrase, and Edie's family takes a big role in the story. And so I've based it a lot on my experiences growing up in Hawaii, my family, my friends, my community. So there's a lot of that. And I think that ties back to the love letter piece of like, this is my love letter to everything that made my experience in Hawaii my experience.
Do you think of science fiction as an escapist genre, or do you think about it as a way to understand the realities of the world we're living in, or if it's a mix of both?
I think it's a mix of both. I think that there is a push in science fiction and genre fiction broadly of people saying, oh, it's not political. And the thing is it's always been political. Going back to Bradbury, it's based on the displacement and the genocide of Native Americans. And so there's always been politics in sci-fi. It's just we don't like to acknowledge it. And I think that there is room in sci-fi for escapism. But for me personally, I think that there's a lot of power in it being political. There's a lot of things you can say with sci-fi as a genre.
And I feel like one of the other important parts of the book is that Edie, the protagonist, I think their trans non-binary or their gender expression is not super cis.
Yes, yes. Edie speaks to my experience in a lot of ways. Edie is Mahu. I identify as Mahu. And Edie kind of embodies masculine energy corresponding to some of my like feminine energy. So a lot of it was my exploration of my own gender. One of the jokes that I tell is that Edie is gender euphoric me. Like if I could be tall and buff and mask, you know, that's who I would be. So a lot of it is my understanding of my own gender, my working through my own gender and what it feels like to be a trans person, to be a Mahu person. I think that it was really important in that sense of like it feels very personal to me. And yeah, I think that it's important to me, and it's also important in this time period to have trans protagonists.
Yeah. And let's talk about the title, too. The title is Super Pigeon. And so I wonder like how you came to that, and then also the reaction from your editor and publisher.
I came up with Hamajang Luck because Hamajang is one of my favorite pigeon words. I just love it. It's so evocative. I love that word. And one of the themes that runs through the book is Edie being someone who believes in luck, someone who is very superstitious, someone who is very convinced that they are unlucky, even though one of the things they're known for as this criminal figure is, oh, we hire Edie because they're lucky. They're a good luck charm. We always bring them on the heist because they're lucky. But they're like, my luck has run out. And so I think of Hamajang luck as like, you know, that messed up kind of like janky kind of luck where it's like, it's not quite right. So that was where the title came from. And I pitched it, I queried it as Hamajang luck, and my agent loved it. My agent was like, no, we should absolutely keep it. Let's come up with, brainstorm a couple different ideas just in case they don't want to keep it, but I'm going to fight for this title because it's so Hawaiian. And then when it sold, I was fully prepared to have to fight to keep it, but my editors loved it. They were like, this is great. We love this title. We want to keep it. So I'm very happy that it worked out because I really like the title and I'm glad that other people like it too.
And so what can we expect from you? There are two more books of yours in the works. So do you have any teasers, any snappy titles for those yet?
Yes. So I'm currently in edits for book two, which is called The Obake Code. And it is a continuation of Malia, the hacker, her story 3 years after the initial heist. So it's a standalone, but it's got some familiar faces, some familiar places, and it's a lot of fun. It's kind of darker, kind of twistier than Hamajang Luck was, and I really enjoy it, and I hope that people enjoy it too. So that's book two. Book three is a prequel to Hamajang Luck, which is it follows Duke and Nakano, who are the two power couple grifters who came together as a pair, and it kind of talks about their foray into a life of crime and where their backstory came into and how they ended up on this zany heist in Hamajang Luck. Obake Code comes out winter 2026, and then the third one is unnamed, but it comes out in winter 2027.
Well, is there anything else that you want listeners to know, or what do you want to leave them with?
One thing I'll leave people with is the importance of trans stories and the importance of Hawaiian stories, the importance of lesbian stories and queer stories. You know, thinking about the world that we're in right now, I think that these diverse stories are so important, and supporting diverse creators is so important. I encourage anyone out there who is thinking about writing a lesbian story or a trans story or a Hawaiian story, like absolutely go for it. You will be surprised at how many people will resonate with it and want to support you and it's fully worth it.
Makana Yamamoto, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
That was Makana Yamamoto, the author of Hamajang Luck, talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. Yamamoto will be holding an event for the book at the Narrative Bookshop in Somerville, Massachusetts on February 19th. Look for links on the conversation page of our website after the show. Hawaiian scholar Mary Kavenapakui is credited with writing more than 50 books, including the Hawaiian Language Dictionary and the Olelo Noiau, a book collection of proverbs and poetical sayings. Author David Del Rocco is on a mission to share her legacy with young readers. He sat down with the Conversation's Lillian Song to talk about his new children's book titled Mary Kavenapakui, Knowledge is Life.
I was a children's librarian for about 12 years in our public library system. And at Punahou, where I was a teacher, I only taught in the academy, which is the high school level. What I had to keep in mind when I was researching and writing this was keep it at a simple level, try to include things that a young kid might find interesting. Like, for instance, Mary Kavenapuku'i had a pet goat. That's not a commonly known thing. And I thought that was kind of cute, especially the fact that the goat didn't like boys and he would butt them if they were near her. But also the important things about her life, all the things that she did. Yeah. So her full name, Mary Abigail Tui Kavenaula o Kalani o Hiiaki Kapolio Pele Kawahine Aihonua Wigan. Her name is interesting because people who dance hula will recognize Hiiaki Kapolio Pele, which is the sister of Pele. And her family was a Pele family related to the volcano goddess. Kawahine Aihonua is the woman who eats the earth. And that was a name for Pele that you still hear in chants. Her last name, Wigan, is because her dad was a Caucasian from Massachusetts. And her mother was Native Hawaiian from Hawaii Island, from Kau.
You're able to, in a very friendly, easy way, tell the story, share how she grew up in Hawaii that had just gone through the overthrow of the monarchy and her language was repressed.
Yeah. One of the scenes I mention in the book is something that happened to her, I guess, when she was a teenager. She was fluent in both Hawaiian and English. She was raised in both languages. And there was a new girl at her school who was having difficulty, and she was a Hawaiian speaker, and Mary wanted to help her out. When the teacher heard her speaking Hawaiian to her, she punished her. For a week, she only got bread and water for lunch, and she had to eat her lunch in front of the other kids. And when her mother found out about this, she pulled her out. So she did not graduate from that school, but she went back to school later because education was so important to her. At the age of 28, after she was already married with kids, which is unusual.
But that is something very memorable. Knowledge is life.
Yeah.
That is a theme, a thread that right. you see throughout.
Right.
And this is really great in that you are sharing her story with Keiki. What is your hope for this book in this series?
Well, part of it is just letting our keiki understand that we have some really important people who came from here who have done great things, and they might not know about them unless they come across these books. And this is the second book, Mary Kavenapuku'i. I started with Patsy Mink. There's actually a coin now out from the U.S. Mint, which is amazing. And the Mary Kavenapuku'i coin is not mentioned in the book because it happened just recently. The third book, I believe, is coming out hopefully in a month or so, and that's Eddie Aikau. And then the fourth book, I already wrote my portion of, which is Auntie Edith Kanaka'ole. And that one probably won't show up until summer because it has to first go to the illustrator. And Auntie Edith Kanaka'ole also has a coin, which did make it to the book. And I know on the continent, Patsy Mink is fairly well known, but the other people that I've written about are not as well known, but you don't know where books may end up, right? And I saw that in New Jersey when I was home and a friend of mine bought 5 copies of Patsy Mink's book for his grandkids and wanted me to sign all of them. So, you know, so people are aware of them because they are available online. And so my hope is obviously the target audience is our youngest readers or kids being read to also, but to get them to be proud of people that came from here. Yeah. And she was so influential in everything about Hawaiian language. Like, for instance, I have a degree in Hawaiian language from the University of Hawaii, and her dictionary was our Bible. Yeah. So I'd like to share my experience when I started with Hawaiian language at UH, because it kind of shows you where things were and where they are now. I quit my job as a flight attendant in 1988 to go to school at the University of Hawaii. And my goal was to get a master's degree in library studies. My previous degree was a bachelor's in Spanish. But I also wanted to learn the Hawaiian language. And I tried to combine the two. My very first class was going to be Hawaiian 101. It was a summer class. And I got there. I was so excited. You know, I'd left a fun job to do something, you know, that I thought was really important. And I get there and there's a note on the door saying class has been canceled, not just that day, but for the summer. And I was—
Why? Yeah. What happened?
I know. And this is in the days before email or cell phones, right? So this is how we all found out, by showing up and there was a note on the door. So I thought, well, I'm not going to take this lying down, because I felt like it was too important. I went to the summer dean's office and I asked if I could speak to him about it. And I told him, I said, you know, I have looked at the catalog and there are about five sections of Chinese 101, five sections of Korean 101, five sections of Japanese 101. The only section of Hawaiian 101 is the one I was going to be in, and it's canceled. And I was wondering what happened. And he said, well, we didn't think there was enough sign up. I said, but this is Hawaii. There's no other place in the world you can learn this language. Within like 10 minutes, he changed his mind. He said, we're going to reinstate it. And he did. So a few weeks later, we finally met, and the teacher was— she was great. The first thing she told us was, yeah, our class has been reinstated. Some Haole guy camped out at the dean's office. And so I said, oh, that was me. I said, I didn't camp out. I told her it took like 10 minutes to convince him this was super important. And he agreed. And we ended up with 13 in the class. So not huge, but enough for a class.
Pat yourself on the back, David.
Well, you know, it's funny because I don't think of myself as an activist, but I was really, really upset. And as I had pointed out to him, there is no other place you can go, right? If they canceled all the Japanese classes, for instance, Japanese is alive and well in Japan, right? But Hawaii has such a small native speaker population. And at the time, very few people were learning it. That was 1988. And so much has changed. Now, there's no question they would never be canceling. The other thing I want to mention, yeah, I remember watching a video of her. She said, to me, knowledge is life. When she interviewed the kupuna for their knowledge, it was all handwritten. You know, this is in the days before computers. Someone had asked her, why are you doing this? Because it was a lot of work. In fact, I saw videos of her with an old tape recorder. But her answer was, if I don't do it, who will? This was at a time when people didn't really respect the culture as much as they should have, didn't recognize how much was already being lost. And she was aware of that. In fact, she was 15 when she started collecting Olelo no Eao, or wise phrases, traditional sayings of the language. How many 15-year-olds are that sharp that they recognize that these Olelo no Eao would be so important? And her book on Olelo no Eao is constantly used by so many people. In fact, as a librarian, I was appreciative of the fact that it has not just one index, but six. So you can look up by place name, by topic, by, you know, several ali'i names. Yeah, just a lot of different ways you can actually access things. So yeah, it's an amazing resource. She wrote over 50 books, but she also composed over 150 oli, or chants, as well as songs. If you go to this website called huapala.org, it's a great local website for Hawaiian music and chants. You'll see her name as the author of a lot of them. And what's good is that website includes her translations, which is good because she was, like I said, she was very fluent in both languages. I wish I'd met her. I moved here in 1981, and I'm not from here. I'm from New Jersey. And she passed away in 1986. So we did have an overlap. I was unaware of her until I started taking the language. But I still was so appreciative of all the work she did, because it informs everything that Hawaiian language students do.
Right.
Yeah.
Just admire her. Like you were saying, as a 15-year-old, she says, if nobody else is doing, I'm going to do it.
Right.
Being that keeper of knowledge, you can go into her translations, her still speaking to us, written work.
Right.
And February is Hawaiian Language Month. Can you leave us with something in Hawaiian?
Well, a very simple one of the Olelo No'eau that she had collected is Makahana Ka'ike.
One more time.
Makahana Ka'ike. Literally, through work is knowledge. Ike has many meanings. One of them is to see or to know in the sense of knowing something, knowing a fact. So you get your ike or your knowledge through your work.
Mm.
Yeah. And traditionally, the Hawaiian way to teach an activity, for instance, is the child that's being taught is not to ask a lot of questions. It's like you watch and then you do. Yeah.
That was retired Hawaiian culture teacher David Del Rocco and HBR's Lillian Song. Del Rocco worked on the second in the Wayfinder book series of Mary Kamena Pukui, Knowledge is Life, with illustrator Storm Kano. This picture book for young readers is available through Beach House Publishing. And now it's time to cash in the answer to today's backyard quiz. You just heard from author David Del Rocco about his Wayfinding series featuring titles on Patsy Mink, Mary Kamena Pukui, and an upcoming book on Edith Kanaka Ole. All three of these women had been featured on U.S. Currency, Mink and Kanaka Ole on the quarter, and most recently, Mary Kamena Pukui on the $1 coin. On the coin's design, she is depicted wearing a hibiscus flower, a kukui nut lei, and an aloha print mu'u. We asked you for the Olelo No'eau that is inscribed on this new $1 coin. Readers of our Akamai Recap newsletter would know the answer since we featured the saying on Tuesday. We were looking for Anana Ike Kumu, which translates to look to the source. And our winner today, Judy Locke from Waikapu, Maui. Congrats, you got it right. That's our quiz for today. If you have one to share, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You know, HBR is celebrating Hawaiian Language Month with a concert series. It kicked off with the all-female trio Kilia in our Atherton studio. The all-male band Hi'ikua will bookend the series. Hi'ikua is a Nahoku Hanohano award-winning trio that's been around for more than a decade. The group carries on the musical stylings of classic Hawaiian musicians like Hui Ohana and Kahau Anu Lake Trio. HBR's Russell Sumiano talked to the band members in our studio.
Aloha. My name is Kamuela Kimokeo. I am the lead guitarist.
My name is Blake Lewikiaili. I'm a father.
My name is Kalehua Krug. I'm the rhythm guitarist of the group.
Oh, when you said title, you meant in the band?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry,
that's why,
that's
that,
all right.
That's why we're here, yeah. You know. Well, that's all right.
I thought you meant my koleana to my family.
It's getting really deep.
Thanks so much for coming into the station. Can you talk about how Hi'ikua came together and how you guys found your sound?
Actually, interestingly enough, when I was in high school, actually, me and Blake played music together. Actually, since King Intermediate, we started playing music together. And towards the end of high school, I actually had Kalehua's cousin, Glenn Maeda, as one of my teachers. And so that's how I met Kalehua, and I started playing music with Kalehua and his cousin. And we played for a while. I had a recording with the group Pilioha. And then when we formed the group Hi'ikua, we were trying to think of someone who could play the bass, and I thought of Blake, who was my classmate, who we played music growing up. And so it just seemed like a natural fit, and it's been a lot of fun ever since we've gotten together.
When the group came together, where were you at in your musician journey?
I was old. I'm about 10 years older than these guys. For myself, grew up listening to the Hui Ohana, and I say Hui Ohana plenty because I think that's how I learned how to sing or how to vocalize, and not really having any formal training at any point in my youth. But for me, it's always when you play with somebody, it's always about how it feels, how it gels, you know, where the bass sits, you know, in the rhythm, in the pocket. And Kamuela me and him have, you know, played music together for a very long time. And, you know, he fits definitely with what my ear wants to hear when I sing.
And what his eyes want to see. I'm very good looking for those of you that are listening on radio.
I completely sit.
With
my eyes forward.
I actually do not have a face for radio. You definitely want to see me in person. I'm pretty gorgeous.
If you can get him on the camera.
Yeah. In one lens.
He's the big lens.
Yeah, but definitely when we started playing music together, and they play different genres that I've always wanted to learn. So they taught me a lot as, you know, I got to hear the sound that I, you know, envisioned myself singing to. And then, yeah, that's how I feel we gelled.
I feel like the bass gets overlooked a lot in a lot of styles of music. What drew you to the bass, Blake?
I guess first, my brother's a bass player. Yeah. He's 10 years older than I am. And so you always want to be like your older brother, so... That's what initially drew me to it. Funny story, when Kamuela called to see if I wanted to jump on as a bass player, I didn't really play bass. And I didn't have a bass at all. But I was a big fan of Pilioha and Kamuela and Kalihua. So to be asked, that was too big of an opportunity to pass up. So I was very grateful at that time. And I still am to be considered worthy of playing bass with these two elite musicians. So, yeah.
Yes, yes.
How fast
so humble, Blake.
How fast did you have to learn how to play bass?
I'm pretty sure my dates are correct, but I believe he called me in October, and in July of the next year, we were in the studio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
He knew how to play bass.
He played it.
Oh, yeah, I played bass.
Oh, you did play bass.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm still really not a bass player, but yeah.
We're coming up on February, which is, as you know, Mahina Olelo Hawaii, or Hawaiian Language Month. Last year, you guys recorded a single titled Kaleo Kupuna, which calls for the Hawaiian language to be part of our daily lives. Can you share the story behind that song?
Kamuela and I co-authored it, and we sat down one day, and after having a few conversations about what are we going to do next, well, you know, what's the next song that we're going to do, and we, you know, basically went through the process of reviewing where we've come, you know, where we've come from, all the recordings that we've actually have waiting to be completed, and just saying, well, what's the next thing that we haven't done that we can add to that list of songs, and so it was actually directly calling, you know, upon language advocacy through music, and it was part of what Kamuela's dissertation was about, just about advocating for rights, advocating for culture, language vitalization through music, through mele. And
yeah, and so it is funny. We actually wrote that song. We wrote it really fast. Mm-hmm. Like, it was in one session. We were sitting in his office at UH Manoa at the time, and when he was still at Manoa. And I remember just starting with the beat, and I said, you know, I want to write something to this beat. Dun, chaka, tika, dun, chaka, tika, da, da. And literally, I was working on the chords, and I had these ideas, and we were like writing at the same time. He was like doing words while I'm making chords. And literally, I think it was within an hour and a half, maybe, at the most.
It was fast.
And, you know, truthfully, that song is one of the more complex musical songs that we've written, where the chords, you know, move and do some pretty fun stuff in there. Yeah, so that's how that song kind of came to be. And also, it was also a combination of both my dissertation, but also Kalehua's dissertation, where he was encouraging us to look at mo'olelo and stories and our older resources for things that we can use as assessments within education. So looking to the voice of our ancestors, to that leo kupuna. And I think that's what his dissertation was about, something like that.
Is everybody olelo Hawaii in the band?
Maybe in different levels, but yes.
In varying degrees, varying degrees. But none of us, neither Blake or me, are close to Kalehua in that degree. Yeah. So when people ask us to olelo, yeah, me and Blake, we probably are more comfortable in conversational.
Yeah.
Whereas anything that's ever formally has to be done, like recording a video or anything like that, we want Kalehua, you got this one.
Yeah, they just get really shy.
Yeah, especially around him, yeah, you know.
As you should.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if to be able to sing in the language, is that like a next level? Like, what is the leap like from just being able to communicate to being able to sing?
There are differences in being able to speak and sing. And truthfully, there are people that sing in the Hawaiian language who don't speak the language, but an ear that speaks the language will hear it immediately, whether they actually speak the language. And it's not necessarily that they're saying the words wrong. You can hear when someone knows what they're singing about. You know, you can hear in specific inflections. So I don't know that it's necessarily an upper level or lower level or anything like that. But I think for those that speak, you can definitely hear when someone is singing a song, whether they're performing it or whether they have actually internalized the meaning and understand, at least to some degree, the depth of what they're singing about, or whether it's just sounds that they've memorized in a specific order. I would say the next step is, so most people can sing in a language. Speaking a language, I would say, is actually the next step. And there's various levels. You know, we want to encourage people to speak at whatever level you're at. You know, we joke about being intimidated speaking in front of Kalehua, but I know that he actually fights that feeling that people have with others, and he encourages people to just try. Like, you know, whatever words you know, use them. And, you know, there's people that will help you and coach you along the way and give you the right words. But I think the next level beyond speaking is writing, composing music, you know, in the Hawaiian language, which we have more of now. But I think an even higher level to just composing music is actually doing haku mele, which is where you're not just translating from English to Hawaiian, but now you're putting in Hawaiian thoughts and depth and speaking the poetry in a way that is uniquely Hawaiian. One thing that I often think about when I hear specific songs is in the Hawaiian language, and being this is Mohino Olalo Hawaii, is if you can hear the Hawaiian song and immediately translate it into English in your head, chances are that same depth is not there. You know, if I can understand it as a conversation, like, oh, aloha bauya, oh, it's something, something, and, I, and like it's in Hawaiian, but I can translate it into conversational Hawaiian right away. So I think that's where the levels go, is you can compose, and then there's like haku mele, where you're literally like haku, weaving in and braiding in all the different meanings into a song.
Those are all the questions that I had. I just wanted to see if you guys can share the details of your upcoming performance as part of HPR's Mele Hawaii series and what folks can expect at your show.
So I think they will definitely be able to expect some of the stuff from our first CD, also some of our original compositions where we're able to give a little more insight into some of the stuff that we've written, which is always fun. You know, it's always fun when you get to hear the story from the composer because you know it's the real story. Unless the composer's a liar, which Kalehua might lie and tell fake stories.
About Kamuela's songs.
Yeah, no, no. We'll definitely do some of our original stuff and give some insight to those who come about what the songs are about, the circumstances of us writing them. But then we'll also for sure be playing some of our island favorites that they'll be familiar with. Yeah. So a mix of old and new, for sure.
Right on. Kamuela, Kimokeo, Blake, Leoiki Haile, and Kalehua crew, thanks for coming to the station. Really enjoyed talking to you guys. I love talking about music and all things Hawaiian.
Appreciate it.
Mahalo, Rasa, for having us.
Those were the members of the music group Hi'ikua. They were talking to HPR's Russell Subiono. We'll have links on our website after the show. And that is it for us today. Up tomorrow, we feature a Lahaina gallery that's rebuilding and bringing back live painting to West Maui. You can find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.